Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
Dr. Redmond.
And we're back for season 13. Now, this won't have seemed like much of a break for all y'all, but we took a little time off between the end of Beyond Borders and this. And if you're wondering why, well, you'll find out in 3 weeks because of the way we schedule these things. Because we don't record one episode of Criminal Minds and one episode of Beyond Borders. That's just how they air. We record all of Beyond Borders Season 2 before we started Season 13. And let's just say we found Beyond Borders Season 2 to be such a dispiriting slog that we actually had to take time away from Criminal Minds. And you'll find out why we thought that, again, in 3 weeks when you get to the final episode. It's a long one.
Yes. Prepare yourself for a two-hour slog.
Two-hour slog about a single episode of television. That's saying something. This isn't Twin Peaks. It shouldn't take us 2 hours to talk about a single episode of television.
Well, it was about the whole season,
yes, you're right. It was actually about, well, no, it was about the whole show, well, not just season two.
Yeah.
It was about the mindset, ethos, worldview that Criminal Minds Beyond Borders espouses and how uniquely awful it is. But again, these are all spoilers. Enjoy the episode when you get there.
Yes, yes. And just understand that it got set off by the end of the last episode.
So, it really did.
And we went on a rant, and I am so
glad.
I hope
you enjoy hearing people talk about Leonard Cohen for 25 minutes, because that happens.
I don't know if it's 25 minutes, well, but no, yeah, we spent a long time talking about
literally just a musical cue. That's how in-depth this episode gets. It's a weird episode, and I'm not shy about saying it. All right. So, let's actually get to what we're here to talk about, which is season 13 of Criminal Minds, which is the point at which the show is beyond help. Like, it can't get better at this point. And it's just, you know, a death spiral downwards, episode after episode after episode.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it had, well, as I would say, as I periodically said, it's like the fall of empires. They don't fall all of a sudden. You know, they just kind of, they have, you know, there's a point at which you know that they're going to, kind of, no, that it doesn't seem to be getting, and then every now and then they have the odd peak and they have a few good episodes, but it's like Alzheimer's,
Well, no, I think one of the best comparisons, right, is the old line. It's like, how did your family lose their money? Slowly at first and then all at once.
And season 13 starts the all at once.
Yeah, exactly. Season 13 is the all at once. It's just terrible from here on out. Like, it's just bad the whole time. But you know what? Let's get to it. Episode 1. Synopsize away.
Wheels up. When an escaped serial killer, Peter Lewis, launches a devastating final assault on the BAU, killing one of their own and taking another hostage in the process, Garcia brings in former international response team member Matt Simmons to help apprehend Lewis before more lives are lost.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't bring him in. He's just kind of there, but yeah.
Well, she phones him because she's got nobody else to phone.
Exactly. And he was the one, and we're established that he is the one outside of the team who knew about the Mr. Scratch investigation. Because, you know, you had to keep someone out of the team in case something happened to all of them.
Yeah.
Which I would raise the question, I don't know why they were keeping it a secret from the rest of their team. Like, it seems a weird thing to keep a secret at all, that you have this elaborate, that Steven's putting together an elaborate file on Mr. Scratch. I understand why there's only a hard copy of it. You know, Mr. Scratch is the best hacker in the world. Like, I understand that part, but I don't understand why the team doesn't know that Steven's been compiling this enormous file on Mr. Scratch. Like, there's no reason to keep that a secret. Except for the reveal in this episode. So, yeah. That bothered me a little. Well, but anyway, yeah, they got to get Matt to join the show. So that's how they decided to do it.
Well, we don't know why they had to get Matt to join the show.
No, well, and yeah, that's a really good question, because, I mean, his character, and I mean, we're going to be talking about this a lot over the next three seasons, but his character adds nothing. Like, that's the thing. I like the actor, Daniel Henney's fine, the kids are adorable. Who plays his wife? He does a perfectly good job. I can never remember her name, but anyway, I've seen her in other things. We'll check later. Right? Everybody's fine. They do a terrible Die Hard episode later starring him. Like,
we'll
get there. But the point that bothers me is, like, you're watching the episode and it's like Steven had a distinctly different energy from other members of the team.
Yeah.
Right? So you could understand why he works as an addition. I don't think he didn't add a lot, but he never had a chance to. He's only in like 10 episodes.
Yeah.
You know, they're not rebuilding the show around him. You know, like, well, we all saw what happened to Rebecca Locke, last time they tried to add a character. Wasn't her name here, but yeah, you know the point.
Yeah. I know the point.
You get the point. But what bothers me about this, right, is when I'm watching it, I don't understand why they thought they should move him over. And again, we have our theories that we can't say on the show, but it's so baffling that they added him because they already had Luke. And Luke, as these three episodes show, is just a much nicer version of Derek.
Yeah.
Like, he's a Derek who's actually good to people and actually nice to people and not a bully and just, like, just a great guy. He just seems like a great guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And by comparison, and I mean, this is not a huge criticism, that's exactly what Matt does. That's what he brings. And that's what he brought on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. He's basically their special forces guy. Their tough guy, the muscle man on the team, right? Who's nicer than Derek was. And why do you repeat that? And why do you kill off a perfectly acceptable character who could have grown into something so you can bring another generic, nice muscle man onto the show?
I have no idea. I've never understood.
But we don't.
But we're not going to
say it. Oh, yeah, we're not going to say it. But let's just say that it is a theory that is not worth talking about aloud. But just ask yourself, why would they repeat characters? Because here's the thing. I watched every episode of Beyond Borders. I can't imagine to anyone that, you know, Matt Simmons was this kind of breakout character that everyone loved and everyone was demanding to see continued the story of. No. Like, when they canceled Homicide... Right? When they canceled Homicide, everyone's like, well, we're sad Homicide's going, but the world needs to hear more of Detective Munch. Right? Like, the world can't live without Detective Munch's super entertaining, unique voice. Right?
Yes. Yeah, so he ends up on Law and Order. He ends up
on Law and Order Sex Crimes. Right? Yeah. They move him over because that's how unique and fun and beloved by everybody that character was. And I think the character has to have that kind of reaction to it for upending a show to add somebody to it feels natural. And I'm sorry, Matt Simmons, you just don't feel that way. You know, it's like, am I crazy here? Or does Matt Simmons not feel like he's working on that level?
Well, what I'm going to do is revisit this issue at the end of the year.
Okay.
Okay, only because I was watching it these three episodes and going, okay, so what purpose does Matt Simmons serve in this show?
Yeah. And you're right. Let's focus on that all year long.
And all I can say is that we may now, because the thing is that we have not had any context, okay, for Matt Simmons.
That's because true. We had never watched. That's right. We had never watched Beyond Borders.
Okay. Now, remember that Erica Messer is the showrunner for Beyond Borders. Yes. She's also the showrunner for this show. And what we know from the last episode of Beyond Borders is that, number one, I guess Scientology really doesn't play a big part in the lack of ethics in criminal movies. But we also have this weird thing, and I'm not going to say what it is because you guys have to listen to the podcast. Just skim to the last 20 minutes or the last half hour, or I don't know where it is. But no, I guess you have to listen to the whole thing to understand the context. But when I think about that last 10 minutes of Beyond Borders, okay, and then maybe that's the rationale. If you think about these three episodes,
okay,
that in somebody's brain, that was the rationale for bringing Matt Simmons and thinking that he was so different and that he brings sort of something, whatever.
Well, you're right. We'll study it over the season.
Let's something wholesome.
Yes.
To this show.
He's just a wholesome family man, which the rest of them aren't.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? Well,
we actually saw his wife get pregnant with number 5 in this show. Episodes.
You know what? And that's something we'll discuss as a theory going forward as we watch the season.
But, you know, that's the only thing. But because it came to me after we've seen all of Beyond Borders, I'm going,
that they might need something. They might have
think they needed it.
No, they think they need. Obviously, whenever I say stuff like that, I mean they think.
And that's because Beyond Borders was such a successful show that its ethos is supposed to be brought into Criminal Minds.
And I'm going to tell you why that your theory that they thought they needed something wholesome and family-y into the show. And I'll tell you why that's wrong. Because Junior shows up in this episode for one scene. And you're like, this is the best family relationship on television.
No. But they would have to have, it may be the best marital relationship. It is not the best family relationship.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? Again, that's not what this episode's about. So we'll talk about that going forward.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, he's in the episode for 3 minutes. And I'm like, wow, he is the best husband in the history of television. There's no comparison.
I don't disagree with you there. Yeah. Everything he ever does, right?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the best family.
No, I know. And we're going to talk about that going forward. I'm just saying, now I'm just talking about his appearance in the episode, and it's stunning what a good and understanding husband he is.
Josh, there it is. Yeah.
He's fantastic. He's so JJ much better than she deserves.
Yes. JJ lucked out.
Oh, God.
At least we all now know that she finally accepts that.
Yeah.
Understands that and makes that decision.
Exactly. And stops living in a fantasy world.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Wheels Up. That tells you how much we really thought of Wheels Up.
It's barely an episode. It's literally just a couple of scenes with Emily where she's tied to a table. Well, hypnotized. We think she's, locked to a table with fractured legs. But no, it's just a hypnosis he's doing. Which, by the way, here's a good sign that it was just hypnosis.
Yeah.
Do you know what a large team of medical professionals it takes and how long it takes them to put that kind of elaborate apparatus in your legs to stabilize fractured bones?
Yeah.
That would take hours and hours and hours, and one guy couldn't do it in a tent. Like, the amount of work it takes. Because you have to figure out you have to use x-rays to figure out the positioning of every bone.
Yeah.
You have to, specifically cut in, find the exact position of every bone. You have to drill in the point. Then you have to put in those metal spikes. And you have to make sure she is completely locked down and nothing moves while you're doing all of that. That is not the kind of procedure you could do in a tent in a warehouse. Unless you had a giant team Breaking Bad style.
Yeah,
like it couldn't work.
You know,
so that should have been the good clue.
Well, yeah, that's the clue for the viewer.
Yeah, for the viewer. That should have been for her.
Well, I don't think it can be because of the power of the drug at the beginning. The drug is going to start to wear off, and the suggestivity is going to start to wear off.
Yeah.
But I think that at the beginning,
she thinks
I could see it. I could actually see it because it doesn't take her that long. It's when he tries to kill her, right?
Yeah.
Of course, that she figures
she realizes it.
Because
and we find out that Mr. Scratch is so bad at his job, he didn't even tie her up.
No, well, he thought, well, yes, but that is goes to his particular narcissism that he can, that he is so powerful.
You say right? that he but didn't we have seen to. That he ties other people up before, over and over and over again.
But he doesn't see Emily as dangerous.
Ah, okay. But he
she's
always...
a woman. Come on.
Right. How dangerous you know? Could she be?
I mean, on top of everything else. I mean, you can imagine his contempt for women.
Oh, God, yeah. No, absolutely. But he did also tie that woman up that one time. Just saying that it's like, historically, he's been very into tying people up to the point that it feels like it's probably part of his weird murder fetish, tying people up. Because he actually does it a lot.
Yeah. Okay, except
he even builds people bondage rings.
Yes, but remember that he is now... what is it? Accelerating. And he is now decompensating. And so therefore he's not thinking rationally. He's got the one person that's going to get him the one thing he's going to get. So he's massively decompensating and thinking and his grandiosity
No, it's not really a good explanation.
Well,
but it really doesn't make sense based on what we see in the episode.
Yeah, but it's an episode.
But yes, he wants to, it's funny because he wants to know where Hotch is. And he's like, I figure Emily will know where Hotch is. And I'm like, well, then you probably shouldn't have rammed the cars because you easily could have killed her with that truck.
Yeah.
You had, like, given what the truck did to those cars, you had no reason to believe Emily would have survived that. Mm-hmm. But they're trying to, like, come up with a reason for him to have done it in the last episode. And so they retroactively say, well, he wanted to kidnap Emily because he thought she was in touch with Hotch. But it's like, yeah, but a good way to kidnap someone isn't to ram their car as hard as you can. It's yeah. not a good in a truck that could easily have killed them. Yeah, that's not a solid way to get the job done. And we have to believe, and here's how, because we talked last season, about how insane it was. That's like, why are you guys going to this takedown at all? Like,
yeah.
You're just going to you're not going to talk to someone. You're going to either arrest someone or shoot him in the face. Let the SWAT team do it. And they mentioned there being a SWAT team, but here is how absent the concept of a SWAT team was. They're like, the SWAT team is right behind us. You know, we'll get on scene and wait for them in the thing. Matt and Garcia make it to the crash before the SWAT team does. So after the crash happens, like, they're cut off, they know that they've been attacked, there was theoretically a SWAT team away, theoretically there are local teams closer, but no, Matt and Garcia can get into a car and drive to the crash scene before any emergency services or the SWAT team that was supposedly right behind them gets there. I'm like, what? How? She could have just met them at the hospital. That part made zero... Although, I guess she immediately had to go right back to work because she has to solve this crime, like she always does.
Yes. Exactly.
All right. Once again, the crime is solved in the most ludicrous way possible. Because, so they're trying to figure out, well, why on earth, right? Why on earth would he have gone to Honduras? And they're like, that's how people, what do you call it? That's how people shorten the term ayahuasca. A-H. And I'm like, but why would, and it makes your head hurt. Why in a fake conversation with Aaron over text messages, that she was actually having with Steven, I guess, to try and lure her. Why would she specifically put in a winking reference to the fact that they think that Mr. Scratch was looking for ayahuasca? Like, why would that be in there? because the problem is, like, it's no, like, both she and Steven know about the ayahuasca, right? And there's no reason to, what do you call it? Both she and Steven know about the ayahuasca, and there's no reason to put it in there to taunt Scratch, because if you let him know that he has ayahuasca, that if you let him know that you know that, that's a convoluted sentence. If you let him know that you know that he has ayahuasca, then he would know his near-death experience ploy is less likely to work, because a guided ayahuasca trip can give you, like, the feeling of the extinction of the self, blah, 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 help people deal with imminent death. Or, you know, eventual death. And, I mean, ayahuasca sounds great, and that sounds amazing, but it's like, if you know he has it, then it's less likely to work, because you'll figure out you're being drugged with ayahuasca. And so I don't understand why she would send that message. And more importantly, why does Reed have to figure this out if the two of them had figured, if Steven and had figured out and told Emily that he was there for ayahuasca, wouldn't that be, like, in the file that he made?
Well, let me just bring up something.
Please.
It is absolutely... I listened to that and went, but it doesn't grow in Central America.
No, it's in South America, isn't it?
But Honduras is in Central America.
I know that.
I'm going, why would he go to Honduras? Why didn't he go to Peru?
Well, yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think maybe he just, his supplier was in Honduras. But, yeah, no, it doesn't really
no,
make sense.
No, I mean, it was just, I just sort of, but that was just one of those things. But it's just that's what they did when they were doing the whole thing with Reed.
Yeah.
Too, right? He was going to Honduras. And so somebody said,
in Mexico, so he had been in Honduras. It must have been because he was hanging out in Central America as part of the Reed taunting. And you're right. The original reason he went to Honduras was just so that they could be suspicious about him being involved in Mexico. And they had to later justify the trip to Honduras, which, as you say, probably should have been a trip to Peru.
Yeah, you know, Peru, somewhere else, even Brazil.
Yeah. Even Brazil, you could have gotten it.
You know?
Yeah, the idea that he's finding it in Honduras seems pretty crazy. And then we get to the most contrived thing, maybe, well, definitely in the episode, one of the most contrived things of the season. So they're like, okay, well, obviously, if he's now using ayahuasca in his plans to, like, create this near-death experience, right? If he's using that drug, obviously he'll be in contact with people who use ayahuasca and religious ceremonies here in Maryland. And I'm like, why would you think that? Why would you think he would have someone local to you who's involving ayahuasca? He can go wherever he wants. He can contact, he can order anything off the internet anywhere he wants. Why would he be hanging out with a local yoga studio where they use ayahuasca for faith healing? Like, why do you think that? You have no reason to think that. But it turns out they were right. Not only is he in touch with that studio and using them to help him source ayahuasca, he also set up all of his crime servers there. What? What an amazing coincidence. Oh, it's so preposterous. Oh, my God.
I'm trying to think, was there ever, I mean, ayahuasca, okay,
yeah.
Ayahuasca is definitely sort of used, but it's very... like it's used on and off, right?
Yeah.
Sort of, but it doesn't seem to have been a major, it didn't seem to have made a major intrusion into sort of the United States that I know of, or Canada. I mean, there is every now and then people.
A story about it and such.
There's a wonderful documentary that was done, a documentary documentarian from Quebec, maybe, yeah. Or maybe Northern Ontario. Anyway, somewhere went down to Peru and went through the whole. It was a First Nations woman who was doing the documentary, right. And she went down to Peru and
to do the whole ceremony.
They did that. Yeah, they did the documentary and the whole thing, right?
Right.
And it's, as I understand it, it's not particularly controllable either. Like, you can't use it.
Yeah, the idea that they thought that you could specifically use ayahuasca to guide her to a specific afterlife thing. No. Like, no. As far as I understand it, ayahuasca is about looking into yourself.
Yeah.
Feeling your connection to how the universe works.
Yeah, it was a strange drug to pick up, but
yeah.
Like everything else in Criminal Minds, I guess Breen found something on the. Now that we know that the writers do their own research, we found that out over the last couple of years, right? Breen
read an article about it, just like went for
decided,
it.
Decided, oh, why don't we throw that in?
So, well, and the funny thing is, so how they find him is even more preposterous.
Yeah,
because they use the unique frequency that he used to trigger the spike trap, right?
Yeah.
Like, they used that frequency to track him to his lair. But my problem is, A, why would that frequency be broadcasting from his lair? He triggered the spike trap from 30 feet away from the spike trap. He didn't, trigger the spike trap at home in his lair and then drive across town to ram them. He was 30 feet away from the spike trap. He triggered the spike trap. He waited for them to crash and then he rammed them. And then I'm sure he turned everything off because the spike trap was done as a plan. But no, we're expected to believe that no, the spike trap signal, which is apparently so completely unique, they could trace that exactly to where his warehouse was. So, can we now talk about how Emily, the show, accidentally told us that Emily considers herself to be, there's no nice way to put this, beyond redemption. Did you catch that? Apparently you did not catch that. Or you've hung up on me.
In the grave. No.
Okay, because she has a near-death experience of seeing her own open grave. No.
Yeah.
But she sees the open grave and she's like, oh, this isn't the same as my last near-death experience, so this must be a trick that he's playing on me.
Yeah.
But the writers, all they remembered was that her near-death experience was being trapped in a cold, lonely place, the Bible describes hell, right? But they've forgotten that the second half of that scene was her desperately saying, I hope that I get better as a person, so when I do die, I don't end up there.
Yeah.
She didn't think that death was a cold, dark place. She thinks that she was going to hell because she's a bad person. And again, the cold dark place is how we're told hell is in the one real mention Jesus had of hell in Lazarus and the Rich Man, right?
Yeah.
And it's key that they used it that first time, but here they just think the writers have, you know, again, as you say, decompensated and think that she just think that that's what happens when you die. No, that's not what Emily thinks. She thinks that's hell, and she was destined for hell unless she fixes things. But this episode says, oh my God, Emily still thinks she's going to hell, subconsciously. And I know the show didn't mean that.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm listening to you and going, yeah, you're right. You know, given our meta, I mean, we don't think much about meta Emily.
But right? She's an alcoholic.
For sure. Meta Emily. She's never.
Yeah. She's not in control of her boozing or barely in control of her boozing. But more importantly, she thinks she's going to hell. She thinks, again, she thinks she's a bad person. And she is so certain that there is no redemption for her in what she did, right? that even in this drug-addled haze, with a, you know, a pastoral version of saying goodbye to the world, she's like, this can't be real. If I die, if I'm dead, I'm going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
That's very dark, and I know the show didn't mean it, but that's what comes across.
Well, no, if one remembers.
You're right, if one remembers not
the
that
previous.
Long ago.
Yeah, and it's not that long ago, but if the writers don't remember, why do you expect the fans to?
That's true. It's just us who are keeping the timeline on this. So
we're keeping the timeline for the whole friggin' show.
That's exactly right.
Nobody's bothering. Else is bothering to do it.
Oh, God, you're right. And it's so sad. But we have to.
Yes.
Well, the show sure as hell isn't.
No. Well, Joe. Yeah, it's, yeah, it is strange that, I mean, I think they thought it was, and when you first watch it, right?
You don't think about that part.
You don't think about it like, and, you know, I'm going.
I mean, I'm sure I don't know if I remembered it when I wrote my review, but I certainly thought about this scene when we were doing the episode about her near death experience. I remember thinking about this scene and thinking about, I mean, I don't remember if that was around the time that it got in my review, but I do remember that when we were doing that episode, I thought about this scene. And how it's like, oh my God, that means Emily thinks she belongs in hell. And that's why she immediately knew she wasn't really dead, because she wasn't in hell. Like, I did remember it then. And oh God, that's so dark.
No, but you're right that
it's
not what they say. No. It's not what they say in the episode. Yes, that it's just, there's just nothing.
Yeah.
It is, but a cold, dark place isn't nothing.
No. A cold, dark place is hell. Being alone in a cold, dark place
dark
forever.
Place, yes. Place, yeah.
Exactly.
And I think that, they just didn't...
they didn't think it through.
Oh, but what are they going to do otherwise to get her out of this, right?
Exactly. No, they needed something to get her out of this. And I get it.
Although, it would have been better if, you know, he had sent her to heaven. But then Peter Lewis doesn't know about this.
That's true.
Peter Lewis wasn't around following the BAU when she went through
her
that
experience. Yeah. That's true. I mean, he knows her file, but I'm sure that part was sure as hell not in her file.
Oh, no. I mean, because it bears no relevance to the file.
Yeah, it's not relevant. And I mean, we know she didn't tell her therapist about it, because she doesn't like all of them, she doesn't believe in going to therapy.
She doesn't tell her therapist about it. She doesn't tell
she only
the priest
tells
about
the
it, because she can't go to her priest, because she's going to hell.
Yep. Oh, no.
And she doesn't want to be convinced that there is redemption.
Exactly. Oh, no. She feels real guilty about the stuff she did, to the point where, as you point out, she doesn't want to be redeemed because she feels so guilty. Mm-hmm. It's a like they accidentally give us a really fascinating character note.
Yeah, on Emily. And it explains a lot, particularly. Like, that's the one thing this show does not ever deal with.
What's that?
Nowhere. No, how is alcoholism?
Nope.
It's, I mean, and it really
never, ever, ever.
Only because I watched the very, very last 4 hours of Prime Suspect.
Oh,
right.
Damn.
And this is a woman, of course, who was also an alcoholic, and she finally has to, she's an Emily character. She never got married, nothing. She's like Emily. And her father is dying, and he just says, but you don't, he said, you have to stop feeling guilty. And she says to him, what do I have to feel guilty about? And he says, nothing. He said, but you still do.
Yep. And you still take it out on yourself.
Yeah. And she's an alcoholic, a massive who screws up a case because she's an alcoholic. And this is finally at the end. She can't stop drinking because she's retiring.
Yeah.
And that you see her in AA meetings, right? Yeah. And how the first one she goes, and then she goes out and gets drunk after the first AA meeting. You know, yeah. She goes for a couple of days, and then something happens, and then she hits the bottle again. Yeah. And then she just doesn't stop drinking. The only thing is that at the end, she is in AA.
Well, so there's a happy message at the end of the whole thing. That's good.
Yeah. Well, except that it's just horrible as she walks away from everything, right? But you know that, you know, she's walking away. And yeah, and now she's going to AA.
Yeah. And so, there is, I mean, at the end of season 15, there is hope for Emily. You know, there is in the same way, hope for Emily. But I don't think the people who make the show understand how much Emily needed that hope.
Yeah. No, and no.
What a sad person she is. I guarantee the people who make the show had no idea.
No, I think that when we it'll be interesting when we go through season 15 a second time.
We're still
off this, but the Emily character was really funny because watching Prime Suspect, which I had suggested on that quarantine thing that we were doing back in May.
Yeah.
To watch it, but I had not even thought about that until I watched this episode, and then I watched these, and we're talking about Emily, and you watch these episodes, and we've talked about the alcohol before, but you know, to watch a show tackle mm-hmm. it, you know, and it had been on and off, you know, people have been saying, I think you drink too much, honey. But it is part of what these damaged people do, so that you don't have to deal with any.
Here's a fun fact that you might not know, and we'll move on after this, we promise. We knew this was going to be a long episode, but we will move on after this, I promise. But here's a fun fact that a lot of people in America, I don't think, know, because they weren't alive when any of this happened. From the 60s through the end of the 80s and into the early 90s, television would very frequently do episodes about alcoholism. It was a go-to character problem to give someone, to the point where it happened all the time, not just on drama, but on sitcoms as well, right? Yeah. That, like, you would have people who had a problem and couldn't stop drinking. Like, there's an arc on WKRP about Herb needing to go into rehab.
Yeah.
Basically, it was talked of very quietly in America. People didn't want to talk about alcoholism. They would make a couple of movies about it. You got your Lost Weekend and such. But generally, it was not talked about, not thought of. Then Betty Ford, the president's wife, publicly talked about her alcoholism and the fact that if she hadn't gotten, like, serious therapeutic help, she would be dead. And the whole country was suddenly willing to talk about it, and they started clinics. And so all of television was like, alcoholism is bad. Too much alcohol is bad. This is a scourge on our nation. Every show talked about alcoholism. And then in the mid-90s, the FCC changed its rules, so suddenly booze was allowed to advertise on television. And, you know, like a train running into a brick wall, suddenly television stopped doing episodes about how alcoholism was bad.
Yeah.
Because the money they could make from the people who sell alcohol was way better than having, you know, moral convictions or doing a good thing for society.
No, I mean, we are getting... Our show is turning into some kind of a sociological look at
America
through criminal minds, and bizarrely. Yeah. But it is, and you can make those connections. And okay. I mean, I was just watching Sapporo, that Japanese beer.
Yeah,
there's a new ad out for Sapporo.
Yeah.
And I just looked at it, right? And I'm just going, why are you guys, I guess what? You think alcohol is better than, that's how you're going to deal with the opioid crisis?
I know.
Make everybody into alcoholics again?
I know, right?
You know, Sapporo, we have gotten so much from the Americans and now we are giving something back to you. And it's an ad for that, and it's Sapporo beer.
Oh, it's so funny. I haven't seen this ad. That's great.
It's brand new. It's only because, like, I'm watching a lot more television than I used to.
There's a plague going on.
And so, I string through the odd time. I'll watch the odd commercial, you know, because I PVR.
But sometimes you're in the kitchen. Yeah. Sometimes you're in the kitchen. You don't want to, you're not going to run back into the living room or run. You're like, I left the controller over and I'm not going to go run for it just to get past a commercial.
Yeah.
I'm not that, you know, I'm not that ridiculous.
You know, so I do listen to commercials, but it is interesting. And these people, except for Daniel, I guess.
Yeah.
Matt Simmons doesn't seem to drink. And
the rest of them do, except for Reed.
Well, yes, Reed, but then Reed's got a heroin addiction, so.
Yeah, I know. He's still in NA, we're sure.
Yeah. So I'm going, they all drink. David Rossi has an alcohol problem.
Oh, absolutely, David Rossi.
Penelope does.
Drinking all the time.
I'm not sure about Adam. I mean, Luke.
Luke might not. Like, that's the thing. We don't get a ton about his personal life, but he's probably not going home to an empty house and having a bunch of drinks the way Garcia definitely is. And we know for a fact that Emily.
And JJ drinks. JJ drinks. You see them on the jet. You know, that's everybody's go-to is let's get drunk.
Yep. It's a rough job, so let's get drunk on the way home. Yeah, that's not a healthy way of dealing. And that's why her husband forced her into couples counseling.
Yeah. Finally.
Finally. But all right, now for the most loathsome thing this episode does, which tries to appropriate Aaron Hotchner's catchphrase as the team's
catchphrase.
Wheels up
in 20. Oh,
screw you, show. That is and will always be Aaron Hotchner's catchphrase, and none of the rest of you have the right to say it. The end.
Yeah, that's
but just
it.
The fact that they consciously, it's bad enough that they're erasing him from the show. The fact that they tried to appropriate his catchphrase, it's just so insulting, you know?
No, I thought exactly the same thing. Yeah.
Okay.
You had to explain why he wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
And then you said, well, no, he doesn't want to come back. And now we have the right.
Yeah, to use his catchphrase.
Like you guys went out and tried to see if he would come back to the show.
I know, right?
As if. You went and called him up and called his agent and said, can you come back?
For one episode. All's forgiven. You know, it's like, come on. No, he was gone for good. You know, because we care so much about Aaron Hotchner as a character and are so fascinated by him, on one level, it's a happy ending for the character to have him just go into maybe private law practice.
Yeah.
And become a full-time dad, like a part-time dad, because let's face it, he's still going to have a job.
Yeah.
The man's not being a full-time dad. Come on. But, like, as interesting as that is, like, and as much of a happy ending as that is for the character, it's not a happy ending that's earned, and it doesn't feel true to the character that Aaron Hotchner is.
Yeah.
Like, Aaron Hotchner is the most fascinating non-Reed character on the show because of his backstory and because all of this is a compulsion for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so to suddenly say, oh no, he got over his compulsion off camera. It's like season 2 of Crime Story, where they're like, oh yeah, all of the stuff that made Ray Luca a compelling self-destructive character, yeah, that's all gone now.
Yeah.
off camera, he became a stable person and no longer an interesting villain.
Yeah, a nice guy.
Yeah. Well, not a nice guy, a 100% competent guy suddenly.
Yes, he's stopped being Tony Soprano.
Yeah, he stopped being, like the real guy. A guy who is more interested in the thrill of crime than the profits of crime.
Yeah.
He's an interesting character that first year.
Yeah. Anyway,
very insulting what they did. We've talked a lot about our feelings about Aaron Hotchner in the past and the mistakes they made with him not being on the show, but this is the final, like, it's adding insult to injury. Not only do we not get to have Aaron Hotcher on the show, but now they're saying he's completely irrelevant to the show.
Yeah. And they even stripped him of his catchphrase. As we said, and now it's the downhill steep.
Oh, at slope. Yeah. So, I mean, I think we talked when he left that, like, that was the last straw of the show. Like, yeah. Because you don't have gravitas anymore, or because the show doesn't have, a moral intellect or even intellectual center anymore. Like, the show is just adrift. And now it is just tail spinning, you know, going down the whirlpool for the rest of the run. Speaking of.
To a better place. When two women from Naples, Florida are found stuffed inside suitcases after being strangled to death, and both crimes are connected to the discovery of an unidentifiable female corpse, the BAU returns from their mandatory vacation to determine what connects the three victims. Period. Meanwhile, Reed learns about a condition to his reinstatement, and the team welcomes Simmons into the fold.
Yeah. This is kind of interesting because they come up with, first off, Tuvok! We all love Tuvok. I love Tim Russ.
Excuse me.
Big fan of Tim Russ from Voyager. Not a fan of Voyager, big fan of Tim Russ.
Yes.
As the therapist who we'll never see again, sadly. Yeah, they needed to come up with an excuse for whatever reasons that we have never fully understood and we were always worried about him when it was happening. Matt Gubler has to take half the year off every year, you know? And we don't know why, and he hasn't been public about it, and maybe, like you said, maybe he's just studying directing, who knows?
Well, apparently that was one of the things I picked off, that he went to film school, so maybe that's what happened.
But the point is, Matt Gubler takes, you know, 6 to 8 episodes off every year, and before they could say he was dealing with his mother, but now they can't do that as easily. So they're just making a part of his reinstatement. Mm-hmm. They show him at the beginning impressing people at the gun range. And I'm like, here's the problem with that scene. He's got a revolver. And the gun range is scored by accuracy and how fast you do it. And had he, like a professional, there been 6 targets and he shot 6 times, that'd be fine. But over the course of this little scene, we see him shoot like 14 bullets. And I'm like, but that means you had to reload twice. Do you know how much time that would add to your course? A lot. So I know that's a weird thing to focus on, but no. They really didn't care about that at all. The only goal here, and this is something that's going to show up a lot over the next 2 years, is they desperately want to butch up Spencer Reed.
Yes. Okay.
They want to butch up Spencer Reed so they can get him and JJ together. That is quite obviously what's happening. Couldn't be clearer. It doesn't go that way, because at the last minute they realize that that would be unbelievably stupid. But this is the first step of something you're going to see across these 2 seasons of the show. We've got the desperate plan to butch up Spencer Reed. And turn
Do you think they could have fixed his hair first?
Like, did you not understand the biggest problem with Spencer Reed is that no one can take that haircut seriously?
You look at him and you go, oh, okay. Huh. Yeah, okay. So let's get
to
the episode.
He's a man you can dismiss immediately. Yeah. Yes, all right. Let's
get to the episode, because I have a question.
I love questions. Mm-hmm.
So where did our unsub find all of those old suitcases that were exactly like the one his mother
had been disposed of in? Maybe his it's weird that his grandmother has only been dead for 3 weeks or 4 weeks at this point. Maybe it's 2 months. Boy, she's only been dead for a little while, and he's already managed to go around and source, 5 different old suitcases.
Exactly the same as the one.
That are incredibly close. Or if not exactly the same, incredibly close to the one his mother was stuffed in when he was a kid by his evil grandmother. No, I know. So close as to be, fundamentally identical. I know. Yes, it's quite peculiar.
It's so funny with these episodes. Is they're so blah that you focus on these stupid little things, right? Because, well, yeah, okay.
Sure, whatever. Let's just keep it moving. One of the things I liked about this episode was, right, they have this whole profile that turns out to be right, right? But their profile is based on nothing. Their profile is literally, so three women are dead, you know, and they're like, how could this man have gotten three women to want to have sex with him and then go to a place so they were vulnerable to be murdered? And they're like, well, Ted Bundy used to, you know, Ted Bundy used to pretend to be injured to get women to be, think he wasn't a threat and get them to come away to a secure second location with him. Maybe this man is doing the same thing, but not physically injured. Maybe he's faking being emotionally damaged. Like, what are you basing any of this on? Because Ted Bundy, you know, essentially just grabbed women off the street by asking them to come back to his car because he had a broken wrist, as featured in Silence of the Lambs, right? He'd be, like, trying to carry something with a broken arm, and he would lure a woman back to his car. This man gets women to go out on dates with him. That's a completely different M.O. that bears no resemblance. You shouldn't be talking about Ted Bundy.
Oh, well,
you have no reason to think he's not just a good-looking man who asked these women out on dates.
Well, let me put it this way. The slop or the laziness of the writing becomes so clear this season.
Yeah.
It's like nobody's even bothering to try.
But that ridiculous line where it's like, the difference is this man must be very passive because he uses his, he uses his injury or emotional image to get women to want to chase him. You're basing that on nothing.
Nothing.
Your entire theory is based on zero evidence. And the thing is, if you had had a scene where they talked to these women's friends and found out that both of them only ever dated sad men that they could try to fix, that would be one thing, but that doesn't happen. You're basing it on zero evidence. Zero information.
But it's the whole problem, like, because I can think earlier, right? That's exactly what they like eons ago in the show, you know, where they would talk to people's friends,
to family members, they would, and friends.
Instead, no, we can come up with something stupid and then get Garcia, we'll just guess and then get Garcia to prove that we're right because she's magic.
But except she does, it's not like she proves them right based on their theory. No. She proves them right because she just keeps searching what the women have in common until she finds out that, like, all of them knew this dead woman.
Yes.
And, who's the killer? The dead woman's grandson. There you go. And does the dead woman have any male relatives? A grandson who's got creepy emotional disturbances. Well, done. All right.
Yeah, I know. It's
all that happens is, like, and what's crazy, what bothers me about it is they spend all of this time, like, making up these theories about the killer based on zero evidence, but then Garcia just finds it based on, well, all of them knew this old lady.
Yeah. Well, no, and that's the whole point, right? It's regular police work. You don't need all of this, but somehow or another.
Yeah.
I mean, the show has lost its psychological way.
Yeah.
Completely. I mean, it just doesn't even bother friggin' trying anymore.
Yeah. Now you get to scenes where they're just like, this guy must be an emotionally manipulative Ted Bundy. And it's like,
Say what? You can do that after Garcia has found some stuff. Maybe.
Yeah, that's fine.
You could start thinking about it, like, and like it's all backwards.
Exactly.
I know. I mean, it's nobody.
Like they're coming up with the stuff you do after you've got the guy in jail and can analyze him. But they're doing it magically based on zero evidence.
Oh, I know. It's just,
it's frustrating.
However, I have to say, it's not Beyond Borders.
No, no, it's not Beyond Borders. That's all I Nothing is as bad as Beyond Borders. I don't want anyone to think that I think this is as bad as Beyond Borders. No, I might be mean to this show. It's not Beyond Borders.
No, no. I mean, that's the funny thing after I watched the three episodes this morning.
Refreshing, right? To not be watching Beyond Borders. We stayed away from this for a week, but really, you know, we probably could have gone right back to it because it's actually a nice palate cleanser after having to watch Beyond Borders.
No, it was.
But yeah, it's a frustrating episode for that reason. It really is.
You know, because you could have done this right.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the story itself is a Criminal Minds type story.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean the massively destructive woman.
Yeah.
You know, who accidentally kills her daughter
and then, you know, covers it up.
Covers it up and then blames the daughter and turns her son into eventually this.
Yeah.
Because she's so afraid of being left by the son.
Yeah. She says, she claims that his mother is this horrible monster and turns the son against all women.
Yeah. And and yet he was old enough.
Yeah, he was like five.
Yeah. You know, that memory, you know, was there.
It's somewhere in his head.
Yeah.
But the grandmother just told him over and over again, you're horrible, you know, abusive, awful mother, you know, left you to continue slutting around and no women can be trusted as a result. No one will ever love you but me, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it is, you're right. It's totally a traditional, like, classic Criminal Minds type of story.
It's right? just and, that it's done inside out, yeah. you know, to complain about they're not sort of delivering the profile.
I know.
You know,
I love that when they do the delivering the profile scene, every single thing they say is based on conjecture and nothing else. Like, just, it's based on nothing. And I love it because it is one of the worst profiling scenes they've ever done.
You know, I mean, I'm just looking at it and I'm just going, like, it's just fluff. But the funny thing is I did remember when it started, I did remember having seen this and I did, and even the next one.
Yeah. The so two things I really liked though in the episode is how wonderfully supportive Luke is of Reed after, you know, this has been his first pointing a gun at someone after he came back from all the trauma. And it's just I'm like how quietly reasonable and supportive Luke is.
Yeah. No, Luke.
It's so nice. And you think about how badly they would have botched it had Derek still been there, right?
Yeah, I know.
But it's like, Luke is just such a great guy.
Yes, and he understands that this is a problem no matter what.
Yeah.
Reed, I mean, he may be the only one on the team that understands that there is something seriously wrong with Reed.
Absolutely.
You know?
And it's like he's trying to counsel him all the time. And I really like, and the show will never really delve into their relationship at all, but this is like a window into it that we really loved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, continue.
Oh, no, what I was going to say, and you'll notice that to further with your butching up Reed theory.
Yeah.
Right? You'll notice that Garcia called him Brainiac.
Yep, instead of Boy Wonder or Boy Genius. Oh, yeah, it's there. There's plenty of evidence that their whole, that their project over these 2 years is let's butch up Spencer Reed.
Yeah, like we're 100%. I mean, we're going to be noting that just so that people don't think that we're going off on a tangent.
No, that's just something we're tracking over the course of a year that there is ample evidence to support.
Yeah.
And this one isn't just us talking about Leonard Cohen for half an hour.
Yeah.
This is real stuff.
And then she... And also you'll notice that the relationship with Luke is very different.
Yep.
From the relationship with Derek and
completely different.
God help us. And if next week we have to deal with Derek coming back, but anyway, we'll deal with that next week.
All right. But yes, and one other thing, Reed was never worried about germs really. Like they, at the last moment talk about how he used to be a germaphobe and he's gotten better. And I'm like, we've literally watched every episode of this show, and there's not a ton of supporting evidence that Reed was ever a germaphobe.
No, I don't know where that comes from.
That comes out of, completely out of left field,
you
right?
You know, he's not a Mr. Monk.
No, he's not a Mr. Monk at all.
He doesn't
wash completely
his hands
different before. Kinds of... Yeah, he doesn't wash his hands all the time. He's not... He ran into a house that was full of anthrax.
Yeah.
You know? So, remember that part? Where he ran into the anthrax house?
Yeah, yeah. Come on, guys. You know, like, I mean, if you were afraid of germs...
Yeah, like he would be much... No, he's never been afraid of germs. The man cooked and, you know, shot up his own heroin. He's not... He is not a fussy or he is not a fussy germaphobe, and he has never been presented as such. So it's so weird to have the characters suddenly say that about him as if this is a well-known trait of Reed that we all know. And I'm like, no, that it just isn't.
Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's a weird line to drop in there, like based on nothing, okay, based on Bruce, nothing we've ever seen the character do.
Bruce,
all right.
Zimmerman wrote it. Where did you get this, Bruce?
Where did you get that idea, Bruce? That he's been,
a germaphobe.
A germaphobe this whole time. I mean, no, he's never waded around in a sewer, but he's never been required to by the story either. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I remember, like, the closest I can think to him, you know, sliding around in the dirt is that one time that Joe Montana was like, I'm not walking down that hill. You go do it. And so it became the character... of David Rossi didn't want to scuff up his new shoes stomping
shoes,
around
yeah.
in the mud. But really, it was like, really, we know it was Joe Montana saying, I'm not walking down that hill. So they wrote a funny line for him to make Spencer go.
Yeah.
But that's all it was. Like, he's not a germaphobe. And that's like the only example I can think of them being anywhere near germs or mud or dirt. Like, it's just, it's not a part of his character.
No, because he's anyway. The geographic profiler.
Like, that's his character. He's the geographic profiler who has an unbelievably screwed up relationship with his mother that's kind of ruined him as a person. There. But it's like, he's not also Mr. Monk a germaphobe. Yeah, so it's very weird to drop that on us at the 11th hour. All right. Yeah. So let's move on.
Yes.
13th
hour.
Nice. No, that's nice.
Okay.
All right.
Blue Angel.
Let's do it. Blue Angel.
When two businessmen in Detroit, Michigan are tortured, emasculated, and post-mortem, the BAU juggles searching for a former escort who was involved with both victims and tracking down an anger-driven serial killer.
She is a current escort. She has not stopped being an escort. She just changed what she started her own website service instead of using the outcall service she was previously with. She has not stopped being an escort. And that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, sex work is like any other work. I'm not going to say she doesn't have a right to, but it's weird that the person writing that synopsis missed the fact that she was still running
an escort
service. She was running
her own
escort
business.
Where she was the only woman. You know? Where she was the only worker. For now. Like, I'm sure she could have recruited. She seemed she seemed to have a good head for business.
Yeah.
You know? Like, 100%. I can see her doing that. If she's picking up 10 grand a weekend, she's got money to invest in other... She's got money to invest in other women.
$9,990.
Oh, you're right. I'm sure he didn't just take a dollar out of his, you know, coin tray to make up the $10,000 that he was paying her. Oh, dude. If you know you're gonna... Like, you know you could just, like... go to the bank twice and get $5,000 a time if you know you're going to see this woman.
Oh, wow.
If you know you're going to be spending the weekend with her, right? On Monday, get $5,000, and on Wednesday, get $5,000. Don't just do this like, you don't think the bank is going to find it suspicious that you ask for $9,999? No, the feds aren't going to hear about it, but the bank's going to know something's up. Oh, that scene. It was pretty funny. So at the beginning of the episode, they try to do a Reed is smart scene by talking about this thing he calls the Linda problem. And it's like, is this woman more likely, like he goes to the Bible woman, is this more likely a bank teller or a bank teller who takes part in feminist causes, right? And it's like, okay, and the whole thing is designed to say, well, you can't say that it's more likely that she's just a bank teller than the other. Because you don't really know anything about the woman, and a probability standpoint, If he's saying that the fallacy is that if you are given two terms and one is more complex than the other, but they both have a common element, you're more likely to believe that the common element is true than the one that is more complex, but there's actually no reason to think that. And I'm like, okay, that's fun, but is that relevant? Like, if you want to make Reed look smart, you should make the psychological, or in this case, statistics-based nonsense he talks about relevant to what's happening this week on the show. But it isn't, which gives you the feeling that this is just something the writer read on a website that week. And it's like, okay, well, I'll just put that in the episode then.
Well, having been a former bank teller at one point in my life, who was involved in feminist causes. Even back then. And I'm going, okay, So yeah. Are you trying to tell us that escorts make more money than bank tellers? I don't know. I can tell you it's true.
100%. Oh, that's funny. I like it if that was actually the message they had meant. I guarantee it's not, but that is hilarious. If that's the only message they meant by including the Linda problem in there.
Yeah, just think if I was a former escort. I would have all these money problems now at $10,000 a week. And oh, God help me. Could I deal with that? No. I have absolutely no idea how.
Yeah.
How sex work do it. I really don't.
Yeah.
But no, it's just me.
It's a but that's just, oh my God. But anyway, so the episode is her dad's returned and he's murdering all of her Johns. Like, that's the plot of the episode. Spoiler alert. I mean, I know you've all seen the episode. And it's weird because it's strange because it's set in Windsor, right?
Detroit.
I'm saying it's Windsor because when Reed makes out the map, to where his lair could conceivably be, like all of the small airports it could be, because on the tape they can hear a plane taking off, right? So it's got to be right next to an airport. So here's all the and it's got to be really close to an airport if you can hear it taking off and it's a small plane. So yeah, it's not actually that hard to find. But two of the airports that he locates in his little geographical profile are in Ontario. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure this, you know, gangster for the whichever mob he was for isn't putting people in the trunk of a car and driving to Ontario to torture them.
Border.
Like, do you know how much of a hassle that would be? I think you can eliminate those two airports. Reed.
Oh, yes. Well, you know,
common sense would dictate.
We all know that the last time we talked about Detroit and Windsor and Port Hope and Sarnia, we got into trouble.
We did. We really did.
One of your readers was so enraged, or our listeners was so enraged that we had sort of messed up on this
which
sort of
border crossing the guy is using and blah, 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 blah.
But yeah, anyway, never mind.
That's a whole other conversation. But this time I will say that you can, if he's a mobster who's used to executing for people for the mob, he's probably not driving all the way to Canada to do it, is my point, and I think my point is valid. Because they sure as hell don't find his lair in Canada.
No.
They sure as hell aren't driving to Canada to get to that lair. So you probably could have left it all up for your map, is all I'm saying. Although, I gotta say, it is weird that it's like, I genuinely, like, I understand this guy. He's an unbelievably toxic, controlling man. That's why he killed the wife who tried to leave him. And then it's like, he was full, they profile him very strangely because they're like, because it was his daughter, he managed to restrain his rage. And so he didn't kill his, luckily he managed to restrain his rage and didn't kill his daughter too, just his wife. And I'm like, do you understand nothing about toxic men? He was never going to hurt his daughter.
He killed
his wife because his wife was trying to take his property from him because that's how he thought of his daughter.
Yeah.
Like,
and you can tell that throughout. I mean, it's written that way.
It's written that way. So how do they psychologically not? That's why these men do this.
Yeah.
She tries to leave and take the daughter. And I mean, some of them are like, oh, well, I will kill the daughter rather than let you take her. But if you're going to kill the wife, you don't kill the daughter, too. You kill the wife to get the daughter back. That's how these men operate.
Well, particularly this one, because he had a sister that he could give the baby to. Yeah,
give the baby to, because he knew he was going to jail over the mob, over his mob getting taken down by the, by the FBI in some kind of a giant organization. I don't remember. They had some clever name for their sting organization on them. Yeah. Operation Nightjar or something ridiculous like that. I don't remember what it was. Operation Butterfly. Anyway, but they had some ridiculous FBI name for it. But the point is, he knew he was going to jail, so he gave he got some fake ID for them, and he gave the daughter to his sister. And he obviously gave him a chunk of money, too, because they have a nice house out in the burbs.
Yeah.
They have a very nice house out in the suburbs. But yeah, like, and I don't understand how they profiled him that badly. Obviously, he killed the wife to get his daughter back. The wife was trying to leave with the daughter because he was a violent psychopath and he wanted, you know, he wasn't going to let her do that. So he wanted the daughter for himself. Like, these people see children as property. That's just how they are.
I would say is that it wasn't even a question of to get his daughter back. I don't even think she got a shot at leaving.
Yeah, you're right. He knew she was going to leave and so he murdered her.
So that
kept the daughter. Yeah.
And kept the daughter, and the daughter wouldn't have known because the daughter was just a baby.
Oh yeah, she was. Yeah.
And then the daughter gets really screwed up because the mother, because her mother, quote, aunt, feels so has always
about the whole situation,
guilty about all of it, and has known all along.
Yeah. So there's been this shadow hanging over their entire relationship.
And
the daughter never understood why it was there, so she could never be close to her mother the way she should have been.
Yeah.
And she never had a father figure of any kind. And she, you know, finds her way into sex work as part of finding out she can monetize human connection.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fine. Good for her. But it does lead her father, who has very, very messed up ideas about femininity and what women should be, that he decides this means she's a whore and he has to fix her. Which, again... Like, the characterization of the dad seems, like, dead on.
Everything about it. Yeah, and the fact that he's killing all of these men
who, quote-unquote, defiled his daughter.
Yeah, and then you know, his daughter's
like, of course he would do that.
Perfectly happy, although he would have ended up killing his daughter and his sister eventually. Yeah, because
and when he realized they didn't fit with what he believed they should be as a family. Yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't in any danger right then.
No.
But eventually they would have been.
Yeah.
Like 100%. I think there's no question.
Because the daughter certainly would not have taken it.
Oh, no. Of course not.
So.
But yeah, she wouldn't have taken it. And so eventually that would have been a problem. But actually, that doesn't matter.
No.
Because the daughter and aunt escape.
Yeah.
Without the team's involvement.
Yeah.
In a nice twist. They actually end up like, The aunt stabs him, and she runs away, and the daughter runs away, and gets away, and he leaves the aunt still alive. So, really, she could have just run away and called the cops, and this would have been all wrapped up. And, oh, by the way, my favorite thing in the episode, so she
she couldn't have called the cops because she ran out of the house, and they were already there.
Oh, no, but I'm saying had the team not been there,
had
the FBI not shown up and involved themselves in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, she could have.
In this case, she still would have ended up in the same way, running away and then the cops.
Running away and then
calling the cops. I'm just saying it's one of the episodes where everything would have played out exactly the same, even if the team had stayed home. But then you get the funniest line of the episode because she's been trying to flirt with Matt the whole time. And of course, he's not tempted because he's perfect. He's a perfect human and, you know, nothing bothers him at all. So what happens is, and this is kind of strange, we get at the end of the episode, he's like, she's like, how did you know it was my father? And it's like, and he responds, because of our profile. I'm like, no, you knew it was her father because you found her mother's body. You had no idea what was going on in this case. You had zero clues and no idea what was going on in the case until you found the skull of a woman who had been shot in the head outside of his torture 25 years ago, outside of his torture dungeon, and then you were in the dental records and found out it was a woman who had been married to a psychopathic mob hitman and had a mysteriously disappeared daughter whose aunt exactly demographically matched the woman claiming to be her mother.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I know.
So no, the skull solved the case. Your profile didn't solve the case. But they always have to credit the skull. Oh, also, yeah, his friend in the local, the Detroit FBI, has a completely unprofessional haircut.
I said, and they no longer care.
Yeah, they don't care at all. But it's like, you got this guy showing up with his haircut where he's got, like, mini tufts all over his head, and he's got a goatee, and I'm like, you're in the FBI!
So somebody, so my answer to that is somebody wanted to hire him, but he didn't want to get rid of the hair and the goatee.
Yeah.
So
we'll hope nobody notices. You're supposed to be in the FBI. You're not even supposed to be drinking coffee, for God's sake. The FBI. They have grooming. Like, this is not me being crazy. They have very strict grooming and presentation rules in the FBI, and a haircut that includes tufts popping up all over the top of it is not one of those approved hairstyles.
And how many FBI people do you see with beards?
I know. No, it doesn't happen. Like, and they can have a mustache.
Yeah.
That's basically it. You know? It was ridiculous when Shamar Moore did it, but at least he didn't have this ridiculous haircut as well as the goatee.
Yeah. Oh.
No.
Like, I don't
just,
know
it's
why,
not
man.
How it's done.
Never mind.
Okay.
We don't talk about fashion. I know. It's not just, it's just not how it's done. I just can't get, after I spent all my rage last week.
That's true.
So it'll take me
a
while
get
to
upset
get.
About this kind of thing.
Nah. And what'll happen is that I am sure that there will be something that will, like, maybe next week already.
The shell shock. No, the shell shock of you and the shell shock of you being so drained by Beyond Borders will wear off at some point, and you'll regain the ability to be mad at Criminal Mind stupidity. But
yes.
Beyond Borders was so awful that it might take a little while to get you.
Yeah. The problems with some of these episodes are definitely there. And it's just nobody's got any, it is true. I mean, here it's almost like nobody really cares.
Yeah. I know, and I use that as my evidence, because I did this fun project that I'm going to have a video up by the time you listen to this, so enjoy that. I did this fun project where I wanted to see if they were ever reusing license plates on the SUV. Because obviously, they're traveling all across the country, right? And so we're expected to believe, and this might even be true, that the FBI has so many thousands of identical SUVs, right?
Yeah.
Wherever they go, there's an SUV that's exactly identical. Now, you and I and the audience knows that it's the actors are always driving and riding around in the same prop cars every single time.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to do was capture all of the license plates, right?
Uh-huh.
And see if they were repeating the license plates. To see if at least one person, right, on the job, like who worked on the show, cared about doing a good job. And I haven't crunched all of them yet. By the time you see this, I will have. But it honestly seems like every single time they go to a new city, somebody went to the trouble of getting a new and distinct license plate rather than just always being the same license plate. And it's like, wow, someone on that show really cares about their job. And here's what I'm going to say is the corollary. Do you want to know how little this show cared at this point? By midway through season 13, they just stopped putting license plates on the cars.
Yeah.
Because even at that point, that's how little they care.
Yeah.
It's not even that they use the same license plate every time. They're just, you know what? It would require effort to screw this license plate onto the front of this car, and I can't be bothered.
And, well, what I would suggest happened is that the guy who was working on this show got a better job offer.
Somewhere the guy that else, was caring about yeah, that prop,
you know, one and of the new prop guy
just didn't bother doing it.
Yeah, they got a new prop guy, and he couldn't care less, and nobody in the show cared.
Yeah, the vibe on the set was nobody really cares. This is season 13. Who gives a damn?
And as a consequence, their numbers, you can tell. Yeah.
You can tell that nobody cares anymore. 100%. You can tell that nobody cares anymore. Like, that's just central to the show. Okay. Oh, and the one last plot thing I'll mention. You got this sex worker. She is understandably nervous about the situation. Why didn't you bring her to a safe house? We'll set up a guard outside your door. And I'm like, or you could just take her to a safe house.
Well,
until you catch the guy.
I didn't even bring that up, but I remember thinking that at the time. It's
like, yeah, you're the FBI. You have safe houses.
All over the place.
The killer definitely knows where she lives. The sensible thing to do would be take her to do what they did back in season 2. Take her to a safe house and then have a woman, an FBI agent, who looks vaguely like her, walk into the house and sit there with a gun waiting for the murderer to show up. That's the sensible thing to
That's
do if you want
to
catch him.
That's the sensible thing to do.
And
but
that
then
would
we, have then,
caught him right away.
Then we wouldn't have had Matt Simmons being honorable.
I know.
And not even tempted.
Not even tempted by this woman. I know.
He is, you know.
Because we had to be reminded that Matt Simmons is a living saint.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. All right, I guess I know why they did it. All right, okay. And that's why that FBI agent had to die, to prove that Matt Simmons is a living saint. That is the blood price of that revelation. I know. All right, so let's move on and say, what are we doing next week? If your homework for next week, if you're watching along with us, is episode 1304 through 1306. So please, tell me what happens in those episodes.
Killer app.
No! Dumbest episode Criminal Minds ever did?
To this point. Okay, so yes, okay. And yes, we all remember this one.
Oh, God, killer app. What's next?
Lucky Strikes.
No!
Oh,
the second dumbest episode they've ever done. All right. But a paycheck for Jamie Kennedy. Nobody's ever going to complain about that.
No, and Derek Morgan gets to come back.
Briefly, yeah. So, all right, go.
Anyway, and then the last one you have to watch is called The Bunker.
Oh, the Daniel Roebuck episode.
Yes, the chef from Richmond.
Not Daniel Roebuck. Who was it? Daniel Roebuck was the guy who... I'm confused. I'm remembering it being Daniel Roebuck because Daniel Roebuck was the one who kept the girls in his cellar, but this is the guy who keeps women in a bunker. So who's the guy? Who plays the guy who keeps women in the bunker?
It doesn't say.
Damn it, I don't remember. Ugh! No,
hey, just a moment. Okay, just a sec. I don't know.
She's going to check for me. Thank you.
It doesn't say his name, so no, how about
Daniel Roebuck...
There's somebody called Corey Reynolds?
I don't know. No, I'll just watch it and we'll talk about it next week.
Which one is Lou Diamond Phillips in?
Lou Diamond Phillips was in an episode?
Yeah, he was in an episode this season.
I've totally forgotten that Lou Diamond Phillips was in an episode.
I'm so glad honestly, he's back in The Prodigal. He's got
absolutely. He's,
regular
yeah,
work.
I mean, I'm going to start watching
renewed.
It.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, we're going to watch it between season 13 and 14. I'm very excited to watch The Prodigal.
Yeah.
The Prodigal Son, yeah, like it's gonna be yay. I love Lou Diamond Phillips. But what bothers me is it's really bothering me now that I don't remember what episode he was in. It's fine. You don't need to say it now. We're gonna find out soon enough.
Yes,
you,
okay.
You don't need to spoil this. All right, so so next week, those are the three episodes. I think you're gonna have a blast watching them with us. We will see you back here for that. But until then, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any suggestions for profiling-related fiction you think we should check out, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We'll see you back here next week on Tuesday for our self-destructive journey through Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. And we'll see you here after that next Thursday for those episodes of season 13.
Yeah.
We hope to see you there. Thanks for listening. And until then, au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.